admitted into paradise. The scholar Sayyid Ibn Tawus cites a report from the Prophet which mentions a great reward for those who fast on the first 3 days of Sha'ban and offer during nights preceding them a 2-rak'ah prayer wherein Tawheed is recited 11 times in each after Alhamd. In the book Kalimatut Tayyiba, according to an authentic narration, once on the first of Sha'ban, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, was passing by a group sitting in one of the mosques and engaged in a debate concerning such matters as predestination and similar controversial issues. They were debating hotly with raised voices. The Imam stopped and greeted them. They answered his greeting and stood up reverently, asking him to join them. The Imam declined, saying, "O people who venture into matters that neither concern them nor are of any benefit to them, don't you know that there are servants of God who have been urged to maintain silence, not because they are incapable or dumb, but because of their trepidation? For indeed they are the most eloquent, intelligent, and wise who have knowledge of God. But when they remember the greatness of God, their tongues fail, their hearts cave in, their minds are perplexed, and their intellects are confused in front of God's might, majesty, and glory. When they recover from this state, they approach God by means of pious deeds, counting themselves among wrongdoers and erring, even though they are exempt from the faults of laxity and negligence. But they are not satisfied with the little service of God, nor do they regard as plenty the works they have done for the sake of God. They do not flaunt their works before Him, and whenever you see them, you will find them overcast with sorrow and awe, fearful and apprehensive. So where do you stand, O band of mavericks, in relation to them? Don't you know that the most knowledgeable of people concerning predestination are those who are the most reticent concerning it, and that the most ignorant of people concerning predestination are those who are most glib about it? O band of mavericks, today is the first of Sha'ban, named so by our Lord because of the ramification and branching forth of His blessings during it. To be sure, in it your Lord has flung open the gates of His paradise and presented to you the spectacle of its palaces and good things, attainable at the cheapest of prices, in exchange for the easiest of works, and yet you decline them. The accursed Satan, too, has presented to you the branches of his multifarious evils and afflictions, and you catch hold of the offshoots sent out by Satan and turn away from the branches of good whose gates have been laid open for you. Imam Ali, peace upon him, continued, "This is the first day of Sha'ban. The branches of its goods are prayer, fasting, zakat, bidding what is right and forbidding what is wrong, kindness towards parents, relatives and neighbors, resolving conflicts between people, and giving charity to the needy and the poor. You burden yourself with a task of which you have been spurred, and venture to probe divine mysteries, an exercise from which you have been forbidden, as those who try to explore them perish. But if you come to know what our Lord, the Almighty and Glorious, has prepared on this day for his obedient servants, you will cut short what you have been engaged in and start doing what you have been told to do. The people said in response to Imam Ali, O Commander of the Faithful, what is it that God has prepared for the obedient on this day? Imam Ali, peace upon him, replied, I will not recount for you anything except what I have heard from the Prophet of Allah. Once the Prophet of Allah dispatched a company of troops towards the people who were staunch infidels. The enemy made a sudden attack at night on Muslims. It was a pitch dark night and the Muslims were fast asleep. No one among them was awake that night except four: Zayd ibn Haritha, Abdullah ibn Rawaha, Qatada ibn Nu'man, and Qais ibn Asim Minghari. Each of them was engaged in prayer and reciting the Quran at one of the sides of the camp. The enemy rained arrows on the Muslims, who could not shield themselves from the assailants, as they did not see because of darkness. Such was their predicament when they suddenly saw lights burst forth from the visages of these four men, which illuminated the battlefield for the Muslim warriors. This gave them strength and morale. Drawing their swords, they gave a good fight, killing the attackers, wounding some of them, and taking others captive. On their return, when they related the incident to the Prophet, he told them that those lights came from certain acts of theirs performed on the first of Sha'ban. Then he described the acts that each one of them had performed. Imam Ali, peace upon him, continued, Thereafter, the Prophet said, When the first day of Sha'ban arrives, Satan spreads out his troops throughout the corners of the earth and its horizons, asking them to try to attract some of God's servants towards themselves. Indeed, God Almighty and Glorious also scatters his angels throughout the earth's quarters and horizons, telling them, Guide my servants and show them the right way, whereat all of them will attain felicity through you, except such of them as refuse and are arrogant and rebellious. These join the party of Satan and enter his hosts. On the advent of the first of Sha'ban, God Almighty and Glorious commands the gates of paradise to open, and he commands the tree of Tuba, whereat it spreads its branches all over the world. Thereat a herald of our Lord Almighty and Glorious calls out, O servants of God, these are the branches of the tree of Tuba, so catch hold of them so that they may lift you up towards paradise. And those are the branches of the tree of Zaqqum, beware of them, let them not draw you towards hell. The Prophet of Allah said, By him who sent me as a prophet with the truth, whoever approaches one of the doors of goodness and piety on this day adheres to a branch of the tree of Tuba and is taken towards paradise. And whoever approaches one of the doors of evil on this day is stuck to a branch of the Zaqqum tree, which draws him towards hell. Imam Ali, peace upon him, continued, The Prophet of Allah then said, Whoever performs supererogatory prayers on this day for the sake of God catches hold of one of its branches. Whoever fasts on this day clings to one of the branches. On this day, whoever makes peace between a husband and wife, father and son, or between two of his relatives or neighbors, or between two strangers, clings to one of the branches. Whoever shows lenience towards his debtor in straits or forgives part of the debt clings to one of its branches. Also, someone who on reviewing his accounts sees that he owes an old debt to someone who has lost hope of reclaiming it and repays the debt is one who clings to one of the branches. Whoever assumes charge of an orphan's care on this day is one who clings to one of the branches. Whoever restrains a fool from compromising the honor of a faithful person is one who clings to one of the branches. Whoever recites the Quran or part of it therein is one who clings to one of the branches. Someone who remembers God and his blessings and gives thanks for them is one who clings to one of the branches. Someone who visits a sick person is one who clings to one of the branches. Someone who accompanies a funeral procession is one who clings to one of the branches. Someone who condoles with the bereaved victim of a tragedy on this day is one who clings to one of the branches. Someone who does an act of kindness for his parents is one who clings to one of the branches. Someone who obtains the satisfaction of his parents after they had been displeased with him earlier is one who clings to one of the branches. Similarly, someone who performs any of the various kinds of good on this day is one who hangs on to one of the branches of Tuba. The commander of the faithful Imam Ali, peace upon him, continued, "Then the Prophet of Allah added, by him who sent me as a prophet with the truth, whoever approaches one of the doors of evil and disobedience to God on this day hangs on to one of the branches of the tree of Zakkum and is drawn towards hell. Then he said, by him who sent me as a prophet with the truth, whoever is negligent of his obligatory prayers on this day and misses them is one who clings to one of its branches. Whoever misses a fast that was obligatory on him on this day is one who clings to one of its branches. Someone who is approached on this day by a weak and indigent person whose wretched condition he knows and he is able to change it without suffering any harm, and there is no one else who may help him and act in his stead, and were he to leave him to languish and perish and fail to give him a helping hand, then he is one who clings to one of the branches of the Zakkum tree. Whoever that does not accept the apology of someone who has done him a wrong and instead of keeping the punishment of the offender within the limits of his offense, transgresses those limits, he is one who clings to one of the branches of the Zakkum tree. Whoever that creates ill feeling between a husband and wife, a father and son, two brothers, two relatives, two neighbors, two friends or two strangers is one who clings to one of its branches. Whoever presses his demand hardly and harshly against someone in a pinch, knowing his predicament, thus adding to his distress and affliction, is one who clings to one of their branches. Imam Ali, peace upon him, continued narrating from the Prophet. Whoever denies a debt that he owes and transgresses against his creditor, forcing him to forego his claim, such a one clings to one of the branches of Zakkum tree. Whoever mistreats an orphan, torments him or unjustly appropriates his property is one who clings to one of the branches. Whoever that compromises the honor of his brother in faith and prompts other people to do so is the one who clings to one of the branches of the tree. Whoever that engages in unlawful singing on this day that prompts sinful actions is one who clings to one of the branches of the zakum tree. Whoever that sits and recounts his ugly deeds in a confrontation or his wrongful actions against God's servants and boasts upon them, he is one who clings to one of that tree's branches. Someone who has a sick neighbor and he does not pay him a visit due to making light of his rights, such a person is one who clings to one of the branches of the tree. Whoever that fails to take part in the funeral of his neighbor for not giving significance to him is one who clings to one of the branches. Whoever is undutiful towards his parents or one of them is one who clings to one of the branches. Also, someone who has been undutiful towards his parents and in spite of being able to make them pleased with him again on this day does not do so is one who has caught hold of one of the branches of the zakum tree. Similarly, whoever that commits any of the various kinds of evils on this day is one who clings to one of the branches of the zakum tree.
Leaked documents expose how major news outlets like the BBC and Reuters were contracted by the British government to push an anti-Russian narrative and further British interests inside Russia and in its neighboring countries. Many of these materials were marked confidential by Her Majesty's government, hoping they'd never see the light of day and that no one would publicly scrutinize them. Well, that's exactly what we're going to do. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. For several years now, we've constantly heard allegations in the media of how Russia has been spreading fake news and disinformation and manipulating social media sites and running troll farms and even journalists to meddle in the political affairs of the United States, the United Kingdom, and their allies. Well, it turns out the United Kingdom has been doing precisely that to Russia. A little hypocritical, don't you think? In a package of leaked documents posted online by the hacker collective Anonymous, we learn how Britain's Foreign Ministry, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, or FCO, sought to spread anti-Russian propaganda and promote narratives that were favorable to Britain and its allies. Under the FCO's Counter Disinformation and Media Development Program, the British government issued this invitation to tender offering millions of pounds for contractors to allegedly develop a, quote, network of NGOs exposing disinformation, unquote. Stated as part of the program's broader goal is to weaken Russian influence in neighboring countries. One of the parties that responded with a bid is the Zinc Network, a collective which includes organizations like Bellingcat and the Institute for Statecraft. Bellingcat has previously denied receiving any funding or information from the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office, yet here we see Bellingcat bidding for a contract from none other than the FCO. And in 2018, they pushed this narrative, which the UK, France, and the US used as a pretext, as a justification to go and bomb Syria. How bizarre. These leaked documents also go on to show how BBC Media Action and the Reuters Thomson Foundation, which are supposed to be the non-profit charities of BBC and Reuters respectively, were also awarded contracts by the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Despite the original announcement by the FCO stating that the program is supposedly open and no attempt should be made to disguise activity, the contract with Reuters, for example, clearly says otherwise and is marked confidential, as are many other documents, which seems a bit odd if you're allegedly trying to promote journalistic standards and ethics to be participating in a secret program with the British government. These documents show how all these various outlets were telling the FCO about the thousands of journalists and contacts that they possess across the world, as if they're somehow boasting how far they can spread propaganda on behalf of Her Majesty's government. This propaganda is a spiderweb, frankly, of synthetic media groups and fronts for British intelligence. And you may recall some of these names, some of these groups like Albany or perhaps the Integrity Initiative, which were also implicated in the British government's propaganda network against Syria, aiming to promote regime change through all these fronts like ARC and IncoStrat, who are also running the White Helmets. Yes, it's a lot to digest, and it's done that way on purpose so that no one knows what's going on and everything remains obfuscated. These news outlets, like Reuters and the BBC, they claim to have an independent editorial board and to be transparent and objective. Yet when it comes to their supposed nonprofits, I mean, there's nothing ethical going on here. Anyone could agree that all of these shady practices have nothing to do with upholding journalistic standards, to say the least. It's interesting to see how the British government is doing exactly what it's been accusing Russia of doing for years. Russophobia has always been an effective political tool, you know, accusing someone of working for the Russians or being a communist in order to smear them. This goes back to the days of the Cold War and the Red Scare and McCarthyism. However, ever since the 2016 U.S. presidential elections, when Donald Trump beat the D.C. establishment favorite, Hillary Clinton, we've heard nonstop whining from the media and politicians in the United States about this made-up Russian interference, Russiagate. And after Trump won, exorbitant amounts of time and resources were wasted on trying to prove that there was some kind of link between his campaign and Russia, with the Mueller report and various other congressional reports that amounted to absolutely nothing. And this is not just in the United States, of course. This is also something that transpired and was carried over into the UK on the other side of the pond. This craze of supposed Russian meddling and disinformation also took root there. And that's no surprise. Wherever the United States goes, the UK follows. We saw former Prime Minister Theresa May decry alleged Russian interference in Britain's elections. They claimed the Russians had interfered in Brexit. They claimed the Russians had interfered in Britain's general elections, in the Scottish referendum even. And just like in the United States, the British government went and started various inquiries, providing an official stamp of approval on its conspiracy theory to blame Russia. Max Blumenthal published an article on the investigative journalism website, The Gray Zone, unpacking the contents of these leaked documents, the stated purposes, goals, and actors involved in these anti-Russian propaganda networks that were cooked up by the British government. And if the contents weren't explosive enough, the article garnered even more attention after Twitter put a warning label underneath anyone who posted it, stating that it may contain hacked materials, as if to say that it were somehow hazardous and to disincentivize people from reading it. Another clear attempt at censorship just because the article, the story, doesn't suit the narratives of Western governments. How surprising. Now, the hypocrisy, frankly, couldn't be clearer. You know, one need only look at other news stories involving leaked documents from other governments, particularly in countries the UK and the US do not like, which received no warning label from Twitter. You can go and post them right now. There will be no warning on them. And just recently, for example, The Intercept published a story which supposedly included leaked documents from the Chinese government. There's no warning label on their tweet when they share the article. We don't even know if these documents are real. It doesn't matter. They can post them without any form of censorship or impediment. The Intercept has also published alleged documents containing hacked cables from Iran. Is there any so-called fact-checking to check if they're real? Or if they are real, was there any warning label on them about hacked materials? Of course not. It's so evident that these big tech and social media giants, who are a main source of news for many Americans and Westerners, they have a double standard. They want to enjoy the privilege of being treated as a platform so that they can't be held accountable for anything people post there, while also performing the activities of a publisher who picks and chooses what to release. And not only that, they also apply another double standard towards news stories that are adversarial to governments that the West is at odds with, while limiting and censoring journalists that question Western narratives and imperialism. Max Blumenthal, journalist and founder of The Gray Zone, who unpacked the contents of these latest FCO leaks, showing how the British government contracted media outlets to sow anti-Russian dissent and pro-NATO sentiment, joins me now to talk more. Thanks for coming on the show, Max. Good to have you on.
Thanks for inviting me on.
So Max, I'll start out with the obvious one here. You know, we've been told for years that it's Russia who's meddling in other countries and in Western democracies and their affairs. And you look at these FCO documents and turns out everything they accused Russia, they're doing. What do these documents tell us exactly?
Yeah, you said it perfectly. The British state, which really is acting as this sort of frontline proxy for Washington here in the new Cold War containment strategy against Russia, is doing everything that it accuses Russia of doing. This is all confirmed. We have the hard details, and this is only a scintilla of what it's probably doing. This is just what we know. And there are hundreds of documents here. I focused on the ones that revealed Reuters through its charitable nonprofit arm, the Thomson Reuters Foundation, and the BBC through its nonprofit arm, BBC Media Action, as well as smaller self-styled independent outlets like Bellingcat and Medusa as essentially intelligence contractors for the British Foreign Office. And, you know, if you look at the whole scope of the documents, they're all focused on trying to counter and squelch Russian media that supports the national interests of the Russian government and the Russian state. And they're focused not only internally inside Russia, but also in Russia's near abroad in the Baltics, Ukraine, Central Asia. They're using not only smaller media outlets and these major media organizations like Reuters, which is the largest media organization in the world. They're also creating family-oriented theatrical events in public parks in the Baltics or soap opera, TV dramas, all sorts of programming to weaponize their media prowess, funded all by the British Foreign Office, to basically hack the brains of the Russian-speaking population within Russia's sphere of influence and affect attitudinal changes. We constantly saw these phrases in the documents, attitudinal changes to make them more pro-NATO. So what Reuters focused on was Russian journalists and bringing Russian journalists over to the UK, funded by the British Foreign Office through tours, and it was all kind of covert. The contracts that I published at the Grayson, they're marked secret, confidential, classified.
Yeah. They're engaging in secrecy. There's a covert element to what they're doing, right? They're trying to hide what's going on. And I mean, isn't that a bit odd considering they're allegedly promoting unbiased journalism and ethics?
Well, in the 60s and 70s, Reuters ran a program for the MI6, British Foreign Intelligence, to produce anti-Soviet media in Latin America and to brand it as kind of independent. It was exposed because the documents were declassified, and Reuters came out and said, we don't do this anymore. This was all in the past. It was a Cold War thing. We refer you to our trust principles, which pledge independence and editorial integrity. And what these documents show here is that they are doing the same exact thing, the same program is in play, and that they've lied. So they have worked to keep these programs secret. One document reveals Thomson Reuters, in its bid to the British Foreign Office, describing how well it kept secret a delegation of Russian journalists to the UK during the Sergei Skripal poisoning intrigue. And they said, Reuters said, we were coordinating constantly with the British Embassy in Moscow to keep this under wraps. And as I mentioned, the contracts between Reuters and the British Foreign Office are marked private and confidential. So they obviously didn't want the British public to know that they're doing this. They certainly don't want the Russian government or Russian public to know about this. And they boast about creating a network of 400 journalists inside Russia. And I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg of what these documents reveal.
So, I mean, if you recall in 2020, YouTube said it's going to be banning videos that contain hacked materials. And, you know, Twitter is citing this hacked materials policy when they censored the Hunter Biden story by the New York Post and locked their account. And now this term hacked materials resurfaces as a label under your article. Where do you think they're going with this ultimately?
Well, just straight up censorship. With the Twitter label, what so many young people saw, who are ideologically unmoored, was that somebody who just simply went out and told the truth got soft censored. And what they see with Julian Assange, if they learn about that, is that someone who simply went out and published true facts was tortured and disappeared. So the idea that we have this liberal society where the truth can prevail and that the society can still be resilient enough and maintain its own national security and advance its national interests while there is a free discourse and citizens are able to criticize their government, that whole veneer has been completely ripped off by these episodes. And it just gets, it's like an onion that just keeps getting peeled away and peeled away until we reach the core, which is just this rotten, festering orb of cynicism and crude, raw power. And I think we're very close to that core right now.
Max Blumenthal, thank you so much for your time. It's great having you on. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast by IRIB English Radio.
Chris Williamson, former member of parliament and close ally of Jeremy Corbyn, attempted to scrutinize these very same programs, particularly the Institute for Statecraft and its integrity initiative, after it targeted Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party at the time, smearing him as a, quote, useful idiot from Moscow, unquote. As a member of parliament, he submitted a question to Alan Duncan, who at the time was the deputy to Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson. Williamson was inquiring about the nature of these programs, but was stonewalled repeatedly on grounds of national security. Chris joins me now. Thanks for taking the time to come on the show.
No, thanks for inviting me back, Richard. Good to be here.
So, Chris, we've been hearing for years now that it's Russia that's, you know, running all these disinformation campaigns and meddling in the US and UK affairs. And it seems now from these FCO leaks that we're doing that in other countries. As a matter of fact, to Russia specifically. I mean, isn't that a bit, you know, hypocritical of us?
Very hypocritical. And I think the political class and the establishment in Britain are guilty of hypocrisy and hyperbole in equal measure. And, you know, Russia may very well be seeking to promote its interests through engaging in an information war. I don't know. There's, as I say, a lot of hyperbole about it. But what is absolutely certain is that we know that the Foreign and Commonwealth Office are engaged in a very significant information war effort, aided and abetted by the so-called independent British Broadcasting Corporation and, of course, Reuters, the biggest media organisation anywhere in the world. And, you know, this goes against the kind of whole ethos, allegedly, of Reuters, who, when they were exposed after papers were revealed under the kind of 30-year rule when cabinet papers are put into the public domain, and it came out that they'd been working hand in glove with the British state to, you know, engage in a propaganda offensive against the former Soviet Union, they were, you know, very apologetic about that and regretful and said, you know, this goes against their ethos. And we certainly don't do anything like that today. And yet we now know from this latest revelations that's precisely what they are doing. And it's pretty shocking, really. And, you know, it just sort of shows the real double standards that are at play here.
So, Chris, there's a video of you in 2019 when you were trying to uncover what's going on. You went and confronted, actually, the Institute for Statecraft at their headquarters in London and even went to Scotland. Can you tell us what you found out about the Institute for Statecraft, their integrity initiative, and, you know, how the government was essentially trying to stonewall you and block you from finding out what was going on?
Yeah, well, I mean, when the kind of hacktivist group Anonymous put a lot of documents into the public domain, which exposed the activities of the Institute for Statecraft and one of their projects called the Integrity Initiative, I started asking questions because, excuse me, within those papers, it was revealed that they were engaged in a propaganda offensive against the leader of the Labour Party and some other key figures at a senior level inside the party, which at that time, of course, was promoting a socialist programme at home and an anti-imperialist agenda in terms of its foreign policy. And of course, this was unconscionable to the establishment, to the military-industrial complex, to the Zionist lobby. And so there were a lot of powerful forces obviously ranged against it. And so I started to ask some questions because it became apparent from these papers that they were attacking Jeremy Corbyn, smearing him, using social media platforms to do that. And discovered through a series of parliamentary questions that the Foreign Commonwealth Office and the Ministry of Defence had awarded the Institute for Statecraft and its Integrity Initiative in the previous 18 months alone in excess of £2 million. However, when I sought to get further information about their activities, they clammed up and said that this would undermine the effectiveness of the programme, citing national security and a whole manner of other ridiculous excuses. So I then took it upon myself to try and find out a little bit more information directly from the organisation and went to Scotland to their registered office, only to find that it's a semi-derelict former paper mill at the end of a half-mile dirt track. I mean, you couldn't make it up, really. They do have offices in London, and as you mentioned, I did go and try to seek some information from the people there. And a chap who... one of the founders of the Institute for Statecraft, Dan Lafayette, opened the door to me. And when I introduced myself and said I was Chris Williamson, MP for Derby North, I'd got some questions about their activities, he unceremoniously slammed the door in my face. I did try to shout a few questions through the closed door. And the thing about the Institute for Statecraft is that they have a range of what they refer to as clusters, journalists, tame journalists and academics, not just in Britain, but throughout Europe and around the world. And their alleged aim is to counter, you know, Russian disinformation. But it is interesting that, you know, this outfit is getting that level of support and the involvement of the BBC and, as I've said, Reuters. It is very, very troubling. And it's just the double standards which gets me. Russia is held up as this bogeyman, and yet the UK is engaged in far more intense sort of information war activities than anything that Russia's ever done. And I just think that's really worrying.
So these government programs, I mean, they're not just for foreign affairs in Russia, its neighboring countries, in Syria, but also at home in the UK, right? Because if they were smearing Jeremy Corbyn, the former Labour leader and leader of the opposition, you know, that means they're going after dissidents or opponents or people they don't like or people who are considered perhaps anti-establishment inside the UK, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, certainly that was one of the main reasons why, of course, I started to ask questions about what their activities, because they were using public money to attack the leader of the official opposition in the UK. And, you know, that is, you know, an attack on our democracy, it seems to me. And that's why I was calling for a public inquiry. But, of course, you see, the agenda that Jeremy Corbyn was spearheading was one which threatened the status quo. It threatened the huge profits that were being made from the military industry, the defence industry in this country. And of course, it threatened the sort of foreign policy of Britain, the kind of consensus that there's been amongst parties, both parties, really ever since the war in terms of its attitude towards Israel. But we had in Jeremy Corbyn somebody who was a very strong anti-imperialist, somebody who was a big supporter of the Palestinian cause, somebody who had, criticised the Israeli state, the Israeli regime, demanded that they comply with their international law obligations. And therefore, he was, it seems to me, seen as a legitimate target, because that would have indeed called into question, the UK's role in supporting Israel and supporting the hugely profitable arms industry in this regime. That obviously was something that they weren't prepared to countenance. And of course, it went further than that, because Jeremy was somebody And the agenda that he was putting forward, of course, gave us hope that we could turn the page on the neoliberal consensus that has caused so much despair and created so much poverty in Britain, the fifth biggest economy in the world, where we have 14 million people living in poverty. And had that opportunity, I think, you know, over time, the Labour government led by Jeremy Corbyn would have indeed done that. And that's why I think they, you know, they targeted him. They targeted him because of his domestic policy and obviously his foreign policy. These were things which were, you know, by these very powerful vested interests that couldn't be allowed to stand. And they did everything they could, therefore, to stop them, including using public money to go after, as I say, the leader of the official opposition in the country. As I say, this goes to the root, it goes to the core of what our democracy is supposed to be about. I mean, you know, it's almost incredible. If you read it in a screenplay before you know, these documents came into the public domain, you'd say, well, that's all very interesting, but it would never happen in real life. But of course, you know, often truth is stranger than fiction, and here's a case in point.
The hypocrisy of the British government and these supposed NGOs and news outlets that they've cooperated with is frankly stunning. You know, they claim to be fighting disinformation while spreading disinformation themselves. It's just plain old propaganda. And no less from establishments like the BBC and Reuters and others who claim to be superior and claim to uphold journalistic standards. For years, we've heard nothing but anti-Russian propaganda from these very same outlets, and fear-mongering about Russian interference from lawmakers on both sides of the pond, and virtually every mainstream media outlet reporting that as fact. And yet, now, when we have a story of the exact same caliber with official government documents proving that the United Kingdom has been doing the exact same thing, complete silence. The media can't even be bothered to report on these explosive revelations of the United Kingdom meddling in the affairs of foreign countries and major news outlets cooperating with them, abdicating their journalistic ethics and standards, as if they ever had any to begin with. Moreover, we see clearly once again how Silicon Valley, how all these tech giants and social media companies are just an extension of the government and a tool used to manipulate public opinion and control reporting that is adversarial to interests of the West. It's an extension of the national security state. Again, is it deplorable? Absolutely. Are we surprised? Not really. We know that these practices have been going on for decades since the Cold War. Regime change and propaganda, these are Britain and America's strong suits and a habit that they can't seem to kick. They continue these Cold War practices while pointing the finger at Russia and accusing Russia of the very same things that they decry. You couldn't find a stronger case of the pot calling the kettle black. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
second phase of the revolution.
Of the revolution. Of the revolution.
Leap in production.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said in his speech in the beginning of the year, 1399, the year which started on 20th of March 2020, the leader said, "I have said several times that the country should become powerful. Becoming powerful is one of our goals. Leap in production and manufacture is indeed one of the tools of power. Production and manufacture should leap, not just prosper. That was said last year. Prosperity of production means there should be a move in production and manufacturing, which has been carried out, but it is not enough. We need very much a leap in production and manufacturing." Last May, in a virtual meeting with seven groups of manufacturing and production, particularly with regards to the agricultural sector, the leader said, "These sections include agricultural projects, especially with concentrating on basic production like wheat, oilseeds, and medicinal plants." One of the important factors which helps us achieve a leap in manufacturing and production in agriculture is the proper management of water resources and having a specific pattern for consumption and preservation of sources of production in a sustainable way. In view of this, we have to have a scientific look at the state of water resources in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Water resources are often divided into two categories, that is, surface water and underground water. Almost all consumption is maintained through these sources. Yet, rainfall and downpour is the main and non-renewable source of the entire water sources, which is changeable from time to time. Surface and underground water resources are completely interdependent on each other, and changes in condition in one will affect the other. According to this natural rule, during dry years where there is little rainfall, the volume of water entering the dams in Iran is said to decrease by as much as 50%. Fortunately, in the Iranian year 1398, that is from March 2019 to March 2020, unprecedented rainfall revived the vast water resources across Iran, and more than 40% of Iran's wetlands were filled in that year. The statistics of the water industry in Iran indicate that rainfall from March 2019 to March 2020 had 100% growth compared to the previous year. In the Iranian calendar year 1397, that is, March 2018 to 2019, Iran experienced the driest year of the past half a century, with just 107 millimeters of rainfall on average in the country. This seriously reduced the reservoirs of dams and intensified water scarcity in cities and villages. Thus, the production of hydroelectric power plants faced one of the hardest periods in their life. But rainfall in March and April of 2019 compensated for 11 years of drought. Generally speaking, rainfall in the West Asia region, including in the Islamic Republic of Iran, is just one-third of the global average rainfall. Iran's share of freshwater resources is only 0.3%, although Iran has 1% of the world's population. Therefore, the high emphasis that the leader of the Islamic Revolution puts on resources and infrastructure is of permanent importance in the process of production and manufacturing. Presently, there are 188 active dams within the country, which surely depend on the annual rainfall for the volume of water being kept in the reservoirs of the dams. Iran's Ministry of Agricultural Jihad has planned appropriate patterns for different climates in the country so that according to existing facilities, water resources are managed and shortcomings are removed to pave the way for further development of the agricultural sector. Ali Zahari, an expert in the field, says on the key role of agriculture for a leap in production and manufacturing, Hari says, Iran, due to a high natural potential, can make agriculture as the agricultural economy as an infrastructure for a development and for a leap in production in other sectors of the economy. This is because many industries are dependent on the agricultural sector, and if agriculture flourishes in a proper way, related industries will also flourish. Leap in production in the agricultural sector can create vast capacities, which will lead to remarkable revenues from export of agricultural produce. Currently, Iran harvests nearly 130 million tons of various crops from almost 16 million hectares of cultivable land. A considerable part of this figure is surplus and can be very lucrative if these crops are changed into different products by various industries with the aim of exporting the produce. Development of greenhouse cultivation is also a good opportunity which can cause a significant growth in the agricultural production of the country. Eventually, it will pave the way for further supply of different products in global markets. In view of this, a leap in agricultural production is in fact an opportunity in agriculture for more endeavor and motivation for boosting non-oil exports.
Economic divide.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavitat Wade. In this week's show, we will be looking at the economy of Myanmar and ascertain just how this nation, gripped by a political crisis, namely because of the coup, can economically survive with massive protests taking place. When it comes to Myanmar's economy, it is one of the least developed of the East Asia region and is basically agricultural. That means much of the population is engaged directly in that field. Nearly half of Myanmar's economy, meaning all large industrial enterprises like the banking system or foreign trade, was nationalized in 1962-63. It talks about how Myanmar's economy was affected by the coronavirus crisis along with the coup. The dip occurs, that's the Q2 of the year 2020. GDP growth rates falling, even though it had the highest in Asia. When you take a look at the GDP for Myanmar, it doesn't have a chance of recuperating because the coup and the eventual crisis has now gripped the nation. It talks about gas prices that Myanmar counted on revenues from that. The revenues comprised 40% of exports and 20% of government revenues for the fiscal year 2018-19. Well, let's now take a look into our first report. It studies how Myanmar had formed a promising economy after a civilian government took power a little over a decade ago, and how the recent political crisis has affected the economy as a whole.
located in Southeast Asia, Myanmar is a country of over 50 million people. The country was ruled by an oppressive military government from 1962 to 2011. It's a nation in transition, haunted by a past marred by authoritarian rule and economic mismanagement.
Although there was the process of democratization in Myanmar, it was a framework by which the civilian government, but the military still had influence in the country. And it needed the influence to protect their huge business and economic interests in Myanmar.
However, the beginning of a democratic transition a decade ago made Myanmar's untapped potential available to foreign investors. Investors pumped money into telecommunications, infrastructure, manufacturing, and construction projects. Joining me in the studio is current affairs and impact analyst Mahan Abedin. We also have with us Khin Za Win, director of the Tampa Dipa Institute. They worked on policy advocacy on communal issues, land, and nationalism. And he was also a prisoner of conscience in Myanmar for seditious writings and human rights work from 1994 through 2005. I'd like to welcome you both. First to you, Khin Za Win. Myanmar's economy dominated by the military junta, even though the country emerged from military rule in 2011. But how much of the economy did the junta control? And how does the ending of the military rule, when it did, impact the economy?
Well, military rule ended, let's say, partly for only 10 years. Now they are back in force. But whatever they did, their economy was not affected. The part of the economy that's controlled by the military is not affected at all. That's the thing that people don't realize. There's the economy that you can see, and there's the economy that you can't see. Now, all that the civilian governments and no power in Myanmar can ever touch. And people think that it has even expanded during the last 10 years.
Well, what does the army control and actually spend its money on?
All right. It has its own bank. It has its own broadcasting station, logistics, you know, a lot of things. Of course, when it wants to buy armaments, they dip into the national budget, you know. But those things, I think it's quite like in China, the People's Liberation Army controls a lot of conglomerates, you know, and that is what is happening. It's exactly what is happening. You see that in Thailand and Indonesia. But in Myanmar, it's even worse because they want political power and they want to expand their economic power as well. This is not limited to the military, unfortunately. There is a budget heading, accounts heading called other accounts, you know, in local parlance. And that means that you can't investigate or find out where those accounts go to. So in Myanmar, a lot of money and a lot of the national budget and income is unaccounted for. It's terrible, you know. We are a least developed country. People are poor. But the military, as well as many civilian ministries, are having their own, let's say, lucrative deals and accounting systems, you know, and it's terrible. It's like all the accounting is done undercover.
Okay, Mahan, Myanmar's transformation from military rule to civilian one took place in 2011. How do you view that? I mean, did the military junta leaders actually give up much of their control over Myanmar when that happened? Or is that just a kind of a facade, which in their eyes, giving up some of the sectors in the economy, for example, would portray that type of image?
Well, I think it was a genuine political transition of sorts, a shift, if you like. But economically, it wasn't, because since the late 80s, the Myanmar military has used primarily two vehicles to drive through its command of the economy. One is the Myanmar Economic Corporation, the other is Myanmar Economic Holding. And through these vehicles, they've essentially controlled privatization, taking up, you know, formerly state-owned enterprises at fire sale prices and giving it to their cronies and associates. And the political transition in 2011 hasn't affected that. So what you find today is that the Myanmar military still controls the commanding high